This is the First Time Podcast.
Part reality series.
Part writer's masterclass. It's a podcast about the first time
you publish a book.
I'm Kate Mildenhall.
And I'm Catherine Collette. Welcome to The First Time. Before we get into our scheduled programming, I did want to say to you, because I listened to it yesterday, I listened to that Jerry Saltz and Charlotte?
Yep.
Good. He's a bit weird.
Yes. Now, I feel like I've said this to you before. Did I not say?
You prefaced that he's a bit strange.
Did I not preface? Okay. So read the book. Have you read the book?
No, I haven't read the book. I actually liked his advice, but I found him quite unusual.
Full on.
Yes.
Very full
used
on.
Her name yeah. every sentence. Every sentence.
Yes. Yeah. I think
like, it's so bad.
I think I actually recently said to someone and they were like, oh, is he the guy who talked to Charlotte? And I was like, yes. And I didn't immediately pick up the book after I listened to the interview, but I have since, and the book is extraordinary.
And it's worthwhile. Yeah, okay.
It's very worthwhile.
Keep it on my list of ones to get.
But, yeah, I mean, people can just keep adding this to the list.
But
of
it was
things,
very
like Alice
urgent
in Wonderland,
one.
Things that Catherine does.
Well, this was, but he was really high up. Like I was going to order him, and now he's down to library.
Wow!
Which is still
so
fun.
He actually put you off.
Well, he did that. I don't know if you remember. He talked something about, and I understood what his point was. He sort of made a comment about how he was very lucky to be born a white man. And so it was a comment on privilege. But then he sort of said to Charlotte, and you're very unlucky to be female. But the way that it came out was sort of, it was not 100% reinforcing his point. It was sort of, I read it as mildly insulting. But anyway,
right.
Maybe I was overly sensitive.
Well, this is a perfect place to start with us talking about engaging with readers, because what that demonstrates is that you can very quickly turn off your readership even after a glowing review by
That's
someone
right.
that you trust. You have moved it down to your library list. Interesting.
Well, it'd be interesting. He could bounce back from there. That's okay. not it, – it can go lower. It can go my physical to-be-read pile, which is like doesn't always have a lot of movement.
So we want to talk about engaging with readers not on the page. You know, that's a craft issue. We're not talking about that. We're talking about your books going out in the world. How are you interacting with your fan base, really? I mean, let's talk about them as a fan base.
You are particularly good at this because, I mean, even from a podcasting point of view, you do the lion's share of social media, don't you? I feel very removed from all that.
We have preferences about the things we like to do. You like spreadsheets. I like social media. I mean, it's a very clear line to set. But I also have very clear ideas about what I didn't do right the first time around with engaging with readers and what I want to do better this time. But I want to start with you. What's the most memorable engagement you've had with a reader of the helpline?
Actually, the most memorable, there's probably two. One was she became a reader, but was, and this is where I sort of feel a little bit sorry for people who are missing out on launches at the moment. But I remember some of the people that came to the launch that were quite unexpected. And one in particular was a woman that I had played basketball with at uni. So probably hadn't seen her for 15 years, and we were Facebook friends. And so I had posted about the launch on my Facebook page, and she turned up, and literally the first time I saw her, she was when she was standing in front of me holding the book. And it was such
gorgeous.
And you get a lot of that at launches and in those first few moments that are not anonymous readers, but peripheral people that really go out of their way to do something nice for you. And that was one that really stood out.
That's nice. And it is a huge thing, but also terrifying because you don't realize that people like that are going to be reading the book, and then suddenly you see them. And then that ripple effect of, oh, if she's reading the book, then
Yeah.
All those other people are going to be reading the book too. Terrifying.
I know the idea of strangers is so much easier, isn't it, than the idea of people easier. You kind of half know. Yeah.
So much easier.
Do you remember?
Strangers don't know. Well, I was going to say strangers don't know what you've mined from your own life and from the people.
Well, that's true too.
People's
yeah.
lives around.
I must admit.
So there's always that feeling.
It's been a big blow at work. I used to sit next to a guy called Jack who's, I think he's in his 20s, but he's just one of those people that always has great stories, like really good tidbits. And so many I have sort of ferreted away in documents that are just lovely little things that I'm going to pull out at some point.
It's a real blow not to be seen. Does Jack know this?
He knows some of it. There's one in particular I'm using in the book that will come out next year that he's actually hooking me up with the person that it happened to because it's quite a complicated fallout from this incident. But it's a really good story.
Oh, my gosh, that's great.
Yeah. But what about you?
I never let him start to write.
Oh, no. Let's flip it back on you. Readers of Skylarking, is there someone special?
I think, and I've probably mentioned both of these before, you know, my year 8 English teacher.
Oh, yeah,
that
gorgeous.
Was pretty delightful. And the girl who burst into tears in the year 9 girl at a school who burst into tears when she got up to the front of the line because she was so overwhelmed. So, and, you know, like they're the moments that are huge as a writer that you kind of store away in your little bag for all the days that feel shit. And
true.
I put it out on Twitter last week. And I said, like, we're doing this, we're looking at this for the podcast, like, what are the most memorable? And oh my goodness, Catherine.
Oh, I did see this feed. This is like people, unbelievable.
Like, and some things, like the extreme. So Michael Pryor talked about a reader who got a tattoo. Kate Forsyth said there were multiple babies named after heroines in her books. There were so many like that. And then there were those kind of big ones, and some of them were a long time ago that you realise, oh, this is the whole reason that people do this. So Anna Whateley, whose new book is just out, Peter Lyre is writing Normal, she had a reader share that she sought a diagnosis after identifying with the protagonist, which was huge. Emma Viskic has had fan mail saying that people who have identified with their characters, especially the deaf protagonist, have changed the relationships with their families.
Yeah, that's profound,
after
isn't
reading
it?
Them. Jeremy Lachlan said kids getting in touch with him, saying that they felt seen, and so many of the YA and middle grade writers who responded were on that kind of idea. So, like, when I put it out there, frankly, I was waiting for kind of the funny or the, oh, that was a nice letter or those kinds of things. I didn't expect to be so profoundly moved, and that what writers remember are these bits of feedback that to them form the basis of why they do what they do, which is huge.
I remember, well, you just sort of, that it feels like such an intimate and beautiful connection, doesn't it? When someone sort of connects on a very deep level. I remember just almost to the point of looking behind me and going, are you talking to me? like that, just, yeah, the beauty of, or just the way that someone expressed what something meant to you, because it is at a level beyond enjoyment, I think, are the ones that really sort of really move
tell
you.
Me, because I can see you at the moment, so I can see how you're moving. How did you actually respond in that moment when someone is, when someone's giving you that kind of very full-on feedback? Like, it's a hard thing to cope with in a way and to accept. How do you do it?
The ones that were more, I suppose, the ones that I remember being really personal were probably written ones. So that sort of takes the pressure off the immediacy of a thoughtful response.
Yep.
But I did respond to everyone, having learnt from you what not to do. But also, I think when the book came out, life was so busy. Like, I could not believe, it was almost like having a baby, and I know a lot of people don't like that analogy, but in the level of, I just don't have time. Like, I remember flying to Sydney and going here and going that, and you were literally sort of going from cab to cab and doing this and doing that and all the rest, that I probably would have cut myself a bit more slack retrospectively that I didn't have to respond that day. I didn't have to respond. You know, you can kind of take your time a little bit as long as you do get back to people.
Yeah, that's so true. Have you as a reader ever written fan mail, or as a reader, how do you engage with writers you admire? Or do you at all?
I haven't. That's actually my aim for the year, that I was going to actually start to send book letters to or emails to writers whose work I really loved, but I haven't done it.
It's been a bit of a year, really, hasn't it?
It's been a bit of a year. So I haven't really. I do follow them on social media. I probably, my favourite is Instagram, though I think Twitter's a lot better for writers. Yeah, that's probably the main thing. But I think I now see the value of a personal, and I appreciate, you know, that personal effort that people put in. What about you? Were you historically a super fan?
No. I mean, I was a super fan, but I was also so completely, I put authors up on such a pedestal that I didn't think you were allowed to write to them.
Yes,
like I agree. I thought that was just beyond. You couldn't do that. But I do remember when I entered a competition and I was shortlisted in a competition that John Marsden, you know, ran, and I got to meet him and he sent me a letter, and I still remember opening that letter. We had a post office box, so it was at the local post office, and I think I just melted into the ground. Like, I was so overwhelmed. I was full fangirl.
Good on you, John Marsden. Not very good on bullying, but you're pretty good in encouraging young people.
I know. He certainly hasn't endeared himself.
But he did write good books. I really liked those books. And he did. I remember him coming to, I'm pretty sure he came to my primary school and my secondary school. Yeah, I definitely saw him more than once.
Yeah, there's lots to like. He's just gone a little. We'll get a lot of mail about talking about John Marsden. But I do think that there is an element of confidence in acknowledging when readers reach out to you. And I think that
that's true.
You just said about that idea that I told you, God, I stuffed up because I didn't respond to everyone, and it wasn't about me, you know, I don't know, thinking that it was against the rules or that it was beneath me or anything like that. It was that I didn't know. It was like that Phoebe Waller-Bridge in the fourth wall. I was like, I don't know what the...
Yeah.
Isn't there a boundary? Isn't there meant to be a wall between me and the reader? And if I broach it here, then what happens? Like if I say thank you, then where does this relationship go from here? So, but I think that confidence, I've noticed when I'm tagging authors on Instagram after I've read their book, and I only ever put up positive kind of reviews or whatever. I only ever say nice things about books I put up. The books that I don't like just don't get up on Instagram. Which is as it should be.
Sorry, Jerry.
I never really expect people to respond, but sometimes I'm really overwhelmed if someone I consider quite famous says, oh, thank you.
Yeah.
Because obviously at some level in their thousands of mentions, they see that they've been mentioned. But I think, so that's been an odd thing. And I think, oh, those people do it because they know it's part of the gig, that as much as you can, you thank people, you engage with readers. That is the way that's part now of the gig. And if you're on social media in a way that means you can be tagged, then maybe you need to be doing that.
Well, I think as well, those more higher profile or established or well-known writers also just say thank you. Whereas probably I think I have to have a more like a 10 back and forth response, when really thank you is completely sufficient, isn't it?
Completely sufficient. You know what? I have a question now about this thank you thing, right? And this will make me seem potentially quite daft and not understanding Twitter at all. And you'll probably laugh because you're like, how are you going to tell me that what works? But let me ask you this question. If you are in that period of publicity and all the rest of it where you're just sitting down at night, you're going, okay, it's 10 o'clock at night, I'm now going to respond to people on Twitter or whatever, and then you just write thank you to everyone.
Oh, yeah. Oh, on an Instagram post and everyone has written, do you write thank you, thank you, thank you, thank you?
I know.
If it's on the same.
Do you just like them all? Do you write thank you to everyone? And on Instagram it's okay because at least they go in between. But if you do it on Twitter, then it's just you saying thank you for like an hour.
Well, you could probably retweet with thanks for all these wishes? I don't know. I'm not. Do you think you could?
I don't know.
I think it's got to be more than someone. Like. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So if someone could get back to us and tell us how you deal with your feed, you know, like this is anticipating that we're going to sit down, Catherine, for an hour responding to all of the amazing tweets about us too. Like,
just
let's not get ahead of ourselves. But there's hacks that I think can make all this business easier, because I think those are the things that make writers go, oh, I can't do this.
Yeah.
It's true.
I'm going to look cool, and
I'm going to look silly.
Or not appreciative.
All right. Other thing, you're quite a fan of newsletters. That is one way that authors do their direct in with their readers. What do you read?
There are some really good newsletters. Do you subscribe to the Chat 10 Looks 3 newsletter?
I do not.
That's probably the best, I reckon, in terms of newsletter content. But they pretty clearly have someone does their newsletter for them, like I think one of their friends, and has a little bit from Lee and a little bit from Annabelle. But that is the top newsletter. Basically, newsletters are links, really, curated links. With a little peppy comment adjacent to the link that sort of, you know, refers to the link and is cute and smart and funny.
Do you do what they tell you to do? So if Annabelle, for instance, had a new book coming out and there was a pre-order link in that, would you press on it and pre-order it?
Would I do that? Not necessarily. Lee Sales in one of the Chat 10 Looks 3 talks about this movie that I have not seen but intend to see. It's about the Aboriginal footballer, Adam Goods.
Is it Adam Goods? Yeah.
The movie that is about his life. And she was like, I never ask people to do anything as members of this or listeners to this podcast, but I ask you to listen to this, to watch that movie, which now I feel really bad that I haven't watched, but I would do something like that.
Yep, okay, interesting.
It was actually at the cinema, so sort of logistically I could probably watch it now. I need to watch this movie, okay?
Yeah, okay.
But things because, like that, yes. Just,
and she, because she's made very clear, she acknowledges the fact that she's not using it to promo
stuff. Although they both have, certainly they refer to their content. I watched all Annabelle's, like the Kitchen Cabinet series. I haven't watched anything more recently just because I watch very lowbrow TV things like Reality Housewives at the moment. But, and Lee's book, Any Ordinary Day is, I'm sure, fabulous, but fairly bleak content. I'm just not sort of in the headspace. So I sort of would support. But then having said that, Alison Tate also has a very good newsletter. Her book is targeted at, say, upper primary, I'd say, or sort of early years of secondary. I definitely bought her books as a consequence, probably of listening to her on the So You Want to Be a Writer podcast and from subscribing to her newsletter.
Because I remembered back to that conversation that I had with John Purcell about what works and what sells books, and that whole thing where he talked about Barefoot Investor and those kind of social media people who have a big following anyway, or who have a newsletter following, who basically say people,
I can guarantee, you know, this much.
Yeah. Yeah. Go and buy my book, go and pre-order it on a Sunday. And then people in Booktopia could just see that
I happens. Feel like that works for him because he's not issues based, but he is a person giving financial advice to a community that is interested in financial advice. Yeah, so that transaction feels really,
and I think like it's an too, with fame, sort of like thing. I think someone like Claire Bowditch, you know, like that. I think big social media, you know, relatively big social media following. That most of the people she engages very intimately in a way with the people who follow her on Instagram, etc. Yeah. And that most of those followers, I imagine, would have gone out to buy her book.
I certainly with Zoe Foster Blake. Have bought her kids' book. She's written adult books as well, which I think I've read one of, but I certainly bought the kids' book because I followed her on social media and so I think it certainly alerts you to something's existence, doesn't it? That's probably half the battle.
Yes. I think what watching those people do well, and what I now recommend to people if they ask me about this, is watch the people that you like and you feel like engaging with on social media, for instance, and see how they do it back, like whether they're just doing their thank yous or whatever. Like watch someone you admire and see how they're doing it and copy it. That's my basic theory for all things.
I feel like it just you can buy books and work because you like a person. I feel like what doesn't really work is the buy my book, buy my book, buy my book.
No, it's buy my book, buy my book definitely does not work. It definitely does not work. And I think that lots of people say, and Anita Heiss actually in this interview, in this episode, talks about artists not understanding the power of social media and what they need to give to be able to do the buy my book part, or just here's photos of my books and all that kind of stuff as well. And I think she's very smart on it. And I highly recommend the conversation to you. This is my plan this time around, Catherine.
Yep.
I am going to thank people, basically, if they take time to post a picture, if they write a review, if they tag me, I'm going to do the basic thank you. If I get tagged in a shitty review, because people do that, I'm going to ignore it and just not deal with it. And I'm going to say thank you personally to people who email or who get in touch privately. That's going to be my kind of little, my kind of little set of rules to myself.
So if you would like a personalised thank you from Kate Milton-Lowell, all you have to do is post a picture.
No. It's just me talking it through without internet.
No, I think it's good. It does make sense.
So we'll experiment. We'll see how it goes. But I really, really would like the advice of the people.
I reckon someone who does it well, who makes it look very easy and effortless, is Rob McDonald. RWR.
Yes.
He's always like great at thanking people and he always seems
very that's so true.
Effortless.
Right, that's it. I'm going out
generous
to stalk. I'm probably going to stalk you on socials, Rob, to work out how exactly how you're doing. Get in touch and let us know what works for you, please.
Dr. Anita Heiss writes non-fiction, commercial women's fiction, children's literature and poetry. A proud member of the Wiradjuri Nation of Central New South Wales, Anita is a lifetime ambassador of the Indigenous Literacy Foundation and in demand as a public speaker and advocate. Anita's first book was Sacred Cows in 1996, and since then her writing career has spanned 18 books, including her memoir Am I Black Enough For You in 2012. Her novel, Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossoms, was shortlisted for the Indigenous Writers' Prize in the 2017 New South Wales Premier's Literary Awards. In 2018, Anita edited the Black Ink anthology, Growing Up Aboriginal in Australia. You can find her full bio in the show notes for this episode. Welcome, Dr. Anita Heiss, to the First Time Podcast.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm excited to be here.
You have been on our wish list for quite some time, and then we had you in Brisbane face to face, and then little pandemic. But that's okay. We're still here together.
That's right.
Anita, I want to go right back. You were a letter writer when you were young. Who were you writing to, and what were you telling them?
That's a really good question. I was very young a very long time ago. I know that I was in one of those, back in the day, we had international pen pal societies and so forth. And I know I was an international pen pal, and I know that I was writing to someone in Japan, and I know that I collected a lot of international stamps. So I would have been, I'm fairly sure, grade five or grade six then. So we're talking about 77, 78, 79.
Love it.
The most interesting letters that I think I have ever written were letters I wrote to my mum when I was backpacking in my early 20s, which she kept and gave, which I still have. And I honestly cannot believe the things I told her, you know, as a daughter to her mother. But the wonderful thing is, well, one, it showed my absolute faith in being able to share everything with her, but also I was incredibly homesick. Best thing of all those letters was when she gave them to me, I used some of them or aspects of them in my novel Avoiding Mr. Right, where the character Astral travels around the world. So I had my travel diary with everything from stubs, you know, to galleries and so forth, and notes that I'd written during being in Pompeii, whatever, to these letters that I'd written to mum. So it was great. So I had all this content that I could just weave into the novel, which was fantastic.
Oh, that's such a great gift that she kept them and gave them back to you.
There are positives to people being hoarders, yes.
Well, I think it's so interesting at the moment too, because so many people are saying this is the time you should be, you know, writing a diary, keeping notes about these times, because like you said, to go back and really get into that
emotion of those moments of homesickness, best way to do it.
And all the detail, though, and all the detail and all the observations. I look back now and I look and I'm surprised at my own capacity or why I even made the observations I did, but they were really helpful. So, and speaking of journal writing and people saying that now, so one of my role models and idols and dearest friends was Rosie Scott, an amazing Australian author who passed away a couple of years ago. But she kept a journal every day for her entire life. And when she came to meet at our writers group, she said, you know, you should write every, you should be keeping a journal all the time. So never forgot that.
Do you do it?
I don't do it because I don't do it, but I suggest everybody else.
I love it. In one of the interviews you did with the Garrett, you said that you didn't necessarily know that you wanted to be a writer. You wanted to be a nun and an air hostess, potentially Ginger from Gilligan's Island. Tell us about when the hunger to write came to you.
That's really interesting because, you know, you'll hear from writers who say they all were always creative and they always wanted to write and they always read and they jump up in the middle of the night and write down their ideas. And I've never been that person, and I didn't come from a home with books, so I would never had a love of reading. And I think a love of writing generally comes from a love of reading. But I was, I guess my foray into writing began when I, as a reaction to being at university and all the books I had to read about anything to do with Aboriginal people being written by non-Aboriginal authors and some of those not ever having been to Australia. So a lot of books about Australia back in the early 20th century and prior to that were written by people in Britain based on letters and journal articles that from people in the new colonies. And I got a book off the shelf in my honours year uniquely titled Australian Aborigines. And it was by someone in Britain based on letters by somebody in the new colony, New South Wales. And this guy would write, today we did this with the natives and today we did that with the natives. And he'd write the letter and he'd send it off to Britain. Now, one day, five Aboriginal men took this fella hunting and they left him for a short period of time and they went away. When they came back, there was only four. So he assumed that they ate the fifth one.
Obviously.
As you right. So he writes his letter. Obviously the natives are cannibals because the five went away and four came back, so obviously ate the fifth one, and writes his letter back to Britain. And I'm horrified by this because I thought to myself, I'd never heard of... So he says, it basically says, he's written down in a history book that I get off the library shelf decades and decades later, right, at UNSW, that Aboriginal people are cannibals. And so I learned two things at that moment. And one was my double epiphany was that there was no such thing as objective history, and the way in which the colonisers remember and record history is significantly different to the way in which colonised peoples around the world remember and record history. And much of the history of this country, at least until the 90s and even a bit later, was written by not the colonised peoples. So that was one realisation. The other was that I had a responsibility as the first person in my family to go to university to have an attempt at storytelling. Now, I wrote from that episode, I wrote a book called Sacred Cows. I had no inspiration or aspirations of being an author. You know, I didn't want to be Ginger then. I did want to be a journalist.
Yeah.
But I wrote Sacred Cows as a reaction to white people writing about black culture. And I said, well, you know, we are bicultural and, you know, Skippy, Vegemite and so forth. So, and then I didn't really ever imagine that I would write another book. I had no idea I'd be sitting here today with, 16 or 18 books under my belt. I had no idea that would happen. I think I got inspired to read and engage with Aboriginal storytelling in particular when I started doing my PhD in 1996. And that came about because I was in Canada working on the Mohawk newspaper and then the National Native newspaper in Edmonton. And I became interested in how our stories were being documented and edited and published. So when I enrolled in my PhD, I started reading all this literature, everything I could buy. And we had a great shop in Sydney at the time attached to Tranby Aboriginal College called Black Books. And I went in there and I literally bought everything I could buy. And I thought, there's this whole genre. And a lot of people don't like calling Aboriginal literature a genre, but I think it is a genre of its own. It has a voice, it has an audience, it has a style of speech and so forth. And so I think it was after publishing a few books, probably when I got into doing my adult fiction, that I really loved the process and fell in love with the process.
That's such a great answer, because it is exactly as you say, such a different diving in point from what so many people did out of this, that kind of reaction, as you say. Do you always know, you've written so much, commercial fiction, literary fiction, children's fiction, memoir, satire. Do you always know what form your next story?
No, I don't. I think that's a really good question as well. I think the thing is, most of my books are a project that has a purpose. So so Who Am I, The Diary of Mary Talents was about, for the first time, writing a novel that went into schools about the stolen generation. So because there is a purpose, there's a direct audience, which then creates, you know, will slot it into a genre and so forth. So quite often I'll have publishers come to me with a concept, and then I'll have an idea, and then marketing departments often work out what the genre is going to be. The play I'm working on at the moment is an adaptation of my novel Titters. And of course, I imagine in here in Brisbane, when it's produced here at Le Boite, that many of the people who read the novel will go to the play, but it will actually probably possibly speak to an audience, a theatre-going audience that doesn't necessarily read novels. And for me, trying to reach as many audiences as possible is my goal. So my current novel, and every one of those in terms of genre and purpose has a different challenge. And my current novel, again, I wouldn't have, it's not something I set out to do. My publisher said, we would love you to do an epic historical novel in, you know, 18th century Australia. And I had no intention of doing anything else after Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossoms. I thought, you know, if I die tomorrow, I'm quite happy having done this story about the POW camp in Cowra. And then you're always looking. For your listeners, I have a very small vocab, incredibly small vocab. And I read somewhere once that George W. Bush has a vocab of 5,000 words. I have a vocab of 5,000 words. They're different words, I'm sure. Very small vocab. So, I have to find different ways of challenging myself when I know that I don't have a huge word list to work from. And so with the new novel, it's called River of Dreams, and I've used a lot of Wiradjuri language in that. And that, so that the publisher said, this is what we want you to produce, an epic historical novel, as opposed to the commercial women's fiction or even Barbed Wire and Cherry Blossoms, which is, most of those novels are around 85 to 90,000 words. And this one, the contract was about 130,000 words, and it'll come in at about 110. I'm like, I don't even want to read a book that's 130,000 words long. But it does mean that you have to make a bigger story, and there are subplots, and there's a complexity to keeping a story interesting and alive for that long. And so that has been the challenge for me. So I think for me, genre-wise, I just want one that I can do well. So I've crossed genres and everything. I do love writing for, say, upper primary because it's easier to do. It's an easier to do. They're 40,000 words. You can still write stories that are entertaining and creative and have a purpose for primary school students. And given that we have a national curriculum, and we do need to have more Indigenous perspectives in the classroom, there's a real need for stories in that area now too.
I think the problem though, Anita, is that you seem to do them all well. So do you just, this begs the question though, if you did find something that you would just went, okay, yeah, I want to stick to commercial women's fiction, do you think you'd be happy sticking with it when you've jumped around?
I love doing those. We could chat about this whole thing about commercial women's fiction, popular women's fiction as opposed to unpopular women's fiction. Yeah. I really love writing those books because you can write about everyday life and how it impacts on women differently, but also what connects us. But you can also have lots of fun, and the research is great. So I had to kind of stop doing those fun sort of books because I'm 50 now and there's not a lot of fun to write about menopause. Not funny that at all. So I don't know. Yeah, it's interesting because I think after I finish this historical novel that I would like to just write. I have got a contract for a young fiction book. So I think it's about keep mixing. For me, it's good to have something different. I can only do one thing at a time though. I know there's other writers, they're writing two or three different things at once. I don't know how they do that. I can't read more than one book at a time either. People do that.
Yeah. I know how. Tell me, I'm so excited now that you've started talking about Rivers of Dreams. Tell me about the research process for that, because I know you've talked about being a method researcher for some of those Manhattan books, etc. What's been the research process for this one?
Well, I did two. I started my Wiradjuri language course at Charles Sturt University. Before started the language course before we had the idea for the book. And then, so I started the course in January, had no idea there was a book on the boil, had a meeting with my publisher in May, still didn't know what the story was going to be about. And then I was learning so much, I was gaining so much knowledge about history down on country, on Wiradjuri country, and learning a whole lot of information that I thought there's some beautiful, our language is beautiful, one. And two, I thought, here's my challenge. Here's what I can do for nation building. I can write a story that brings our language back to life and documents a particular part of history. So it's set in Gundagai in 1852. There was it's known as the Great Flood of Gundagai. It's one of Australia's greatest natural disasters. A lot of people don't know about it, but over 3 days, the town flooded and a third of the town drowned.
Wow.
Two Aboriginal men went out on bark canoes and saved 59 lives. So last year, no, the year before, there was they were given posthumous heroism awards last year. And that prior to that, there were the main street of Gundagai erected bronze statues of the men. And so the novel is really about bringing to life this moment in time, in a time where Aboriginal people were without rights, being moved off country, living on rations. There were massacres across New South Wales or across the whole country. And here's two men, before reconciliation ever started, going out and risking their own lives to save the lives of white people who may or may not have even, you know, given them the time of day in real life. And so it begins with that, but it's really a story of heroism and homecomings. And the story moves to Wagga and a young girl who is then searching for her way back home. So the method researching really was in my language class, but also I organised a row to try and understand what it may have been like to be on the river. Now, the men went out over 3 days in the middle of winter, in the middle of a flood, raining the whole time. We go out, I think there's about 20 of us, on a gorgeous November day, sun streaming down, beautiful flowing, there's a current, but, you know, you can't imagine what it was like, although I did fall in and I had a fleeting absolute fear, but would have been nothing like anybody in the flood felt, because I was surrounded by people who had a life jacket on and so forth, and there was no way I was going to drown. So the idea about that was actually trying to be on the water, being able to, we went 20 kilometres towards Wagga, it's the way the river runs out of Gundagai, and the Murrumbidgee, and just looking at the width of the river and, you know, what the landscape looks like and imagining, you know, how it would have been. So loved every minute of that. Very different to going to Manhattan and going to Square Gardens and Central Park and the Museum of Sex, where the security guard followed me while I took notes and I was like, I'm writing a novel. And very different, but I try not to write about a place I haven't been to ever, very rarely. And, you know, I think for me, the authenticity of the character's life in the novel is born out of me having walked, counting the steps from her home to the bus stop or the train station, or what the view is from the restaurant into the car park in Canberra or whatever it is.
And you've co-written some books with Adam Goods, for instance. How does that process work? How does the co-writing process work? I'm intrigued.
Well, that's a unique situation. I've done, so we'll do that one first compared to other projects with kids, or I mean, with, not with their kids. Okay, so Michael and Adam was a unique situation in that they're mates, obviously, and technically Adam is Michael's uncle, but they're incredibly close, and I'm friends with both of them and in doing different things with them. But essentially what I did was, the idea was, you know, in the Good Weekend, they have the two of us and they ask the same questions, right? So yep. It was born out of that idea in a session with the publishers. And I just texted them both and I said, I have got this idea. What do you think? They're like, yep. And so that was great, easy. And then I asked them both exactly the same questions. You know, how did you grow up? What was your favourite thing at school? Did you get in trouble? Yada, yada, yada. Who's the funniest out of you two? Out of the two? Who looks the best in the Swan's Guernsey out of the two? And I had lots of fun because they're both incredibly humble, but very funny.
Yeah.
And I was desperate because we were writing for young kids, right, and about reaching their goals, because neither of them knew they were going to be AFL legends. So it's the stories are really about saying to kids, you know, if you want to do this, you need to do this. But, you know, this is what their lives growing up were like. The thing is, they both had very strict mothers, right? So they weren't naughty. I was just looking for some naughty thing that I could say, okay, yes, you can be a Brown, win the Brownlow twice and be Australian of the Year and still maybe have done something. Mickey O broke a window at school or something. I could see he would be a rat bag. But they were, I really enjoyed that process. So I basically interviewed them, pulled the text together, got them to check it and so forth. So to make it as easy as possible, because they're both incredibly busy. Different to working with the kids at La Perouse on Yira and Her Deadly Dog Demon and Demon Guards at School Yard, which was a really long process where I love that process because I began by asking them all to bring in their favourite book, because I had no idea what kids read. And I hadn't written a kid's, really a young primary school book like that. So they all brought in their books that ranged from Emily Eyefinger and what's the Duncan Ball books? Selby the Dog.
Oh, yep.
Like the Complete Encyclopedia of Fishing, which I did not read. to a whole lot of, and so it was really interesting for me to see what these kids at the same age were interested in. And then we brainstormed everything. We voted on names of characters and they got into groups to create who Yira's friends would be, what Yira would do on the weekend. Another group did the family tree. So they all had a say. And then they went through drafts. They saw how draft process works. Adam Hill, the original artist, came out and he did some artwork with them in the class and he showed them how he created Demon the Dog. And so they actually learnt the process. It was a 3-year project. And then the next one, I drafted up something and then took drafts out based on what they were doing in the school. So they were already, they had a harmony garden. And we did go to Bondi Beach because in the novel, the dog ends up, they end up going to Bondi Beach. So we had a trip to Bondi Beach where we had Clarence Lockie show us around the sites at the North End and so forth. So they had clipboards with questions. They had to sit down and they had to write down, you know, if they saw any animals on the beach. So they had tasks to do, and then I wove in their writing and their observations into the story so that they could genuinely say that was their work.
What was their reaction when they finally saw the finished product? Like, what was that celebration like?
They're all authors now, aren't they, Miss? An author. Which is great because essentially they are. I think the first book was the first novel co-written by Australian students. And the second one, the first one, another Australian author, a lot of those kids from LAPA Public go to Matryville High. Then another Australian author messaged me one day on Facebook. He said, I've just started work, you know, doing some creative writing at the high school. And I said to the kids, we're going to write a book. And they're like, yeah, we've already written one. Great. You know, it's really good. And, you know, I just want them to understand the process of writing, but I want them to love writing and then hopefully love reading.
Did that process of working with the students, were you able to bring anything back to your own practice from them in terms of the way they were telling stories or seeing the world?
I think for littlies, I do a lot of workshops in schools. So, and I really love it because what you see working with particularly, you know, kindy through to even year eight is this no fear, no shame, no self-censoring for good and bad, just throwing themselves into creating the most colourful, interesting, outrageous characters that they can. And I think sometimes, I know I do it all the time, this whole self-censoring sort of thing, and just the freedom I think that they bring to the creative process. And I think when I see that, it reminds me that we don't give kids enough opportunities to actually be creative. I mean, I don't know about you, but I don't know that we ever did it when I was at school, but it was a different time. And so when I see, when I get the opportunity to go into schools and kids thrive, it's like, oh, you know, that. If only we could do this all the time. But, of course, you know, curriculum is packed and so forth. And the other thing is, one of the things that's quite cute is, you know, I have a process and a, you know, schedule of what we do to cover throughout the day. And at the end of every every workshop, they have to, as a group, in groups, create a piece of writing that they then perform. So it may be a skit, it may be a song, or maybe a poem or whatever. And nobody wants to do it at first, and then everybody's competitive. And in a good way, not in a bad way, but it's like, yeah, can we go first? Yeah, and it's really lovely to watch them come together creatively, but also to work as a team, and then to be proud of what they've produced. So we have it's a school in Brisbane, outside of Brisbane, called Goodna, and I've done a couple of days or years of workshops up there. And one NAIDOC week, every class got up and they performed their work, and it's 1,000 kids in the hall, and I just go, oh, that's the joy. Yeah. That's so beautiful. No, it doesn't answer your question.
No, it's great though, because it so often is the joy, and for those kids as well. Anita, you do loads of work in schools, loads of festivals as well. Can I ask, what's been your favourite ever festival gig?
The best ever, and it's interesting, that's an interesting question, because I only recently searched and found the video from the 2013 Byron Bay Festival. So young Tom Eddy made this fantastic video that just captured the essence with some great music of that entire festival. Now, there was one panel at that festival that I did. I think it may have been the last panel or one of the last of the entire festival. And it was titled Chicklit Mass Market, Am I Literary Enough For You? And on that panel, it was chaired by Moya Say Jones, and on the panel was Lisa Walker, Ed Chatterton, and Colin Falconer. And I think about this all the time. I don't even know why we laughed. There was so much laughter. There was a chemistry on that panel that I've never had before. We bounced off each other. We made fun of each other. The more we laughed, the more the audience laughed. And there's this video footage that has captured all of that. And I just thought that, for me, because I do so many panels that are so serious and about issues that, we're dealing with every day in terms of Indigenous affairs and so forth, that it was the perfect end to any festival. So, yeah, Byron's pretty good. They always have an innovative they're not afraid to have a political program. When the weather's good, which is not always, but I've only ever been there in beautiful sunny weather. It's outdoors. There's lots of people buying books. It's a really good festival.
I love that, because and I wanted to ask you about, you know, what makes a good festival, but you've already answered it in that, and that chemistry, I think, is so important, and it's so hard to get right, I imagine, for people who are programming festivals as well. How do you know you're going to hit the magic?
Can I add to that? Yeah, so that doesn't happen all the time, and you know, it's a rare occurrence. But can I also say, in terms of what, for as an author, for me, the most important things are like a chair. A chair can make or break a panel, and you know whether they're prepared or not. It's both the panel members and the audience need a chair that can drive channel the conversation, make sure everybody gets equal say and so forth, doesn't engage in jokes, because I've been on panels where, you know, with the chair and one or two members and it can be very alienating. So I think a decent chair, and I think being programmed on panels where the author, whoever the author is, has the capacity or has the opportunity, I should say, to just talk about their work, talk about their passions, and actually engage with the audience, because they're there for the audience. Mm. And so I think that's really important. And a good green room, a decent green room, because people might think that's a really weird thing, but for many, 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 many years, until recently, the Melbourne Writers Festival had a green room the size of my kitchen, pretty much. And for an international festival, and I just going to think, you know, you do need, as a writer, you have to gather before the panel. Sometimes you just need to go and just have a quiet space and so forth. And so a decent green room where you can print something out, have something to eat, have a cup of tea or whatever, it's really important.
What's your process for nailing a great speech?
That's a hard question. I don't know if I'm nailing a great speech. I'll tell you what I do. I research my topic, whatever the topic is, well. In recent years, I'll have conversations with the CEO of the organisation or whoever the organiser is to let them know what track I'm on. I research the audience. I'm always interested in knowing who's in the audience so that I can make some specific references to one or two or three people or groups of people, and I practice the speech quite a lot, even though I may be fine-tuning it, you know, an hour before. I practice pauses, jokes, and all. Always have a PowerPoint, so they're not looking at me, they're looking at pictures.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so for me it's sort of like I try not to write about, I try not to say yes to things I don't know anything about the content on. But I have found ways, and I usually find ways to, whatever the topic is. So I've been invited to give a keynote at a gambling harm conference. And so I went to look at literature in Australia that looks at gambling. And will you believe, you probably know this, that Possum Magic has in it where they're traveling around the countryside trying different food, and then they go to the casino.
They do.
Right. And so I'm just like, okay, so embedded is gambling in our culture that one of the most iconic, if not the most iconic book of this country has its child, little kangaroos going to a casino. Horrified. So I do try with all of my keynotes, regardless of the topic, I will try and weave in Australian literature.
So good. You've noted in a Q&A somewhere that impatience is a trait that you deplore in yourself. But I was wondering if that's maybe a necessary partner of kind of drive and ambition and how much you get done.
Well, so I mean, the impatience thing is of myself, but also of generally people I love, like my mother. But I've worked for myself for so long. I've been in ISO for a long time. And people, my friends said to me, how don't you watch TV all day? And I'm like, oh, my God, I don't get paid if I watch TV. I can go days without turning it on. I said, you know, when you work for yourself and you're writing in particular, you know, I have to work 12-hour days to get paid for 8 normally. I've always been very scheduled. I'm a very scheduled sort of person. I've run 3 calendars. I've got a booking agent. I used to have a life coach we would set goals to reach my goals and so forth. What's interesting that we're having this conversation now is that what I've realized in the last month, so the first couple of weeks I didn't cope very well because there's a difference with being working at home with being forced to stay home. And not being able to just go out to a coffee shop and sit down and meet your friends for breakfast or whatever. I had nearly a month since I've had a meal with somebody. So I didn't cope very well for the first couple of weeks. And one of the things I realised was related to impatience or patience was that the expectations I'd had on myself to create, to produce, particularly with the novel, I can't, and neither can other people, expect ourselves to deliver in the same way as we do normally because we are not in a normal situation. So even though people say, you've got more time, you're at home, there's all this white noise that people, you know, tens of thousands or hundreds of thousands of people are dying around the world with a disease that is also close to home. And so I think for me, one of the lessons of COVID was actually reining in this impatience of self in particular, and that my expectations of me are far higher than anybody else's expectations of me. And so I think that's been a good lesson. But it is true that my impatience I have to reach the deadline. My deadlines are always long before somebody else's deadlines. I'm not impatient about starting another project, although they're all there waiting. You know, I've had contracts, they all have to be done. But as I mentioned, I can only do one thing at a time. So I need to knock this novel over. Be kind to myself.
I love that you've just touched on calendars, deadlines, your hands are moving around as we're talking about this, because just following you on Instagram, I am always like, my jaw drops at how much you fit in. And that's just what we're seeing. That's just that part that we're seeing. So you said then you've had a booking agent, etc. How do you do it, Anita? How do you make your life work?
So right now, it has modified slightly because we're not, I'm not going over to UQ and I'm not going to the library. So I think we all have had to find different ways to make our days work, to be as productive as we can. And so I do emails before sunup. So I'm up at 5:30, do emails till about 7 now. Then I exercise for an hour. And then I do bits and pieces. I make no phone calls during the day. unless it's an absolute emergency, I'll say to people, send me an email because I can read it overnight and I'm back in the morning. Or I do phone calls when I'm walking. I write in, I have three calendars synced, well, almost synced. I send myself calendar invites all the time. So I've got everything, I know what's happening for the day. I write in chunks of time. So today I'll go, I'm going to write from 9 till 12, then I've got an hour to prep. So I have my day, you know, a vague idea of how I'm going to plan my day. And then after I finish talking to you, I go and exercise for a half an hour. I've already walked 4Ks this morning. And so I'm a massive scheduler. You know, I used to be a huge to-do list, but I just put everything in my diary, and this is all in my head. I used to know before everything was cancelled my flights for the rest of the year. So I just knew that what was coming up. So I think I'm a plotter in terms of writing. There's plotters and pansters. Mm-hmm. So I map everything out in terms of the novel before I even start writing. So that is pretty much how I live my life. God, it sounds boring.
No, it sounds incredible. My mind is blown.
What it means is because I can plan it all out, I kind of fit more in, I think. I don't know. Who knows?
So in terms of that plotting, just as a random sample, when you sat down to write this morning, for instance, did you know exactly where you had to jump in? Did you have a word count? Did you know what you had to nail today to get out again at 12 o'clock? Like, how does that work?
That's a good question too. So today was slightly different because I'm editing, but what I knew I had to do today by 12 o'clock, which I did, was to, I had to just reread the last chapter of the novel and finish the epilogue. So I'd already had a draft. So this is I've got the edit back from the editor. So I've had the structural edit done. I'm now doing the edit. And so just prior, I got that far just prior to sitting down for an hour before speaking to you, I started doing another spell check and going through that. And so, but generally, if I'm working on a novel, my methodology is I have a synopsis, I break down my character breakdowns, I map out the entire novel chapter by chapter with some dot points under each thing, and then I'll do my research and then I'll sit down to start to write. This novel's been significantly different because I was writing and researching at the same time because I was trying to write as much as I could when I was in Wagga like four or five times a year. But generally speaking, that process, so my previous novels, the Chick, Avoiding Mr. Right, Not Meeting Mr. Right, the Dreaming series, I wrote those in, say, 8 to 12 weeks because I'd done all the research and then I would sit down, it's all mapped out, and then I would just sit down and I would just write for 5 or 6 days a week, all day, lots of Red Bull, lots of chocolate, which I don't do anymore, although I've had about 6 chocolate weeks today. But anyway, so I write in blocks of time. I'm not one of these people who can get up and say, oh, I think I might, okay, I've got a spare minute, I'm going to write half an hour. That doesn't work for me. It's like premeditated. I have to know tomorrow I'm going to be writing from here to here. So I really do miss, I don't like writing at home. I like to be at the library. I like to go to the library or a cafe or somewhere else where it's a neutral, Spain, for instance. Yeah.
Delightful.
Cafe.
We can dream. Anyway.
Yeah.
You also mentioned about getting outside and getting your exercise in. You run marathons. Tell me about the marathon running and all your extraordinary discipline in getting that sorted.
Well, I don't run marathons anymore. So I ran my first one on the eve of my 50th birthday, and then I ran three in about 11 months, and I think I'm still so that was a couple of years ago. Never imagined I would do that, but it's also about goal setting, which is what to liken marathon running to writing a book is it's all about starting, really. And so once you start, the finish is great, but you can't get there unless you start. So, and it is about training, and with running, you are training every day, you're stretching, you're doing a whole lot of, you're researching about how to keep your body fit, nutritious and so forth. And it's very similar to writing a novel, which is a marathon epic. I think it's probably easier to run a marathon than write a book, to be honest with you, because a book takes much longer, and anybody can really get themselves into shape to run a marathon. And so I think for me it's about commitment and dedication and determination on both fronts, because people will say to me, oh, I'm not a runner. I'm going, well, if you start running, you are. Mm. But it's also like, oh, yeah, I want to write a book, and I'm like, well, write it. And so it's not going to write itself. It's not going to write it from your head in the shower. If you really want to do it, you sit down and you do it. But I think, and it's the same with exercise and so forth, but the whole running now, particularly during COVID, and I've always run for my mental health, just because it's a great way to clear the head. You know, you can think about, like this morning, I read your questions for today and I was giving them some thought while I was running. Well, I walked this morning. But, yeah, I think at the accomplishment you feel at the end, at the finish line, whether it's the New York Marathon or whether it's at your book launch, I think there's still the same sense of, I did this.
You travel so much, and I have seen on Instagram that you are often in the hotel gym, etc. Do you have put a really strict schedule in place for yourself when you're touring and away from home as well?
I try where I can. I'll stay in a hotel that's got a gym. Or that I can run somewhere. And most recently that was quite difficult because I was in India and I think I got to one gym in a hotel and there was nowhere to run. I just couldn't run anywhere. Because one, because of smog, and two, because it was just impossible. So I think I ran out years ago when it was a novelty to travel. It was like, oh, I'm going to eat the Pringles and I'm going to have the minibar because it's kind of like the holidays. But when you're on a book tour for 6 weeks, you can't do that because you'll end up toxic. Which did happen when I was touring, avoiding Mr. Right. So because every speech I gave, every talk at a library I gave, they gave me a box of chocolates and a bottle of wine, you know, because you don't get paid. And I'm like, oh, my God, yeah, so we're driving in the car, and let's get this box and we'll drink the wine tonight. And so, but I do try to stick to a routine as best I can. If I'm away for a period of time, I will go to, I don't think where I was recently, and I'll go to the shop and buy yogurt and so forth and just try and do it myself. But always, I always have my running shoes in my case. To walk, and it's a great way to see a town or wherever you are.
You've got background in marketing and things as well, Anita. Tell me about the way that you run your social media.
I was a publicist or a communications advisor for 2 years with the Australia Council back in 2001 to 2003, and I used to do PR for some Aboriginal events, and I think I really love, I really love social media in that as a writer because it connects me with readers all around the world. And I think one of the positives out of the negative of COVID is that so many events now are online and Zoom. And what that means is students in Japan and my colleagues in Barcelona and my publisher in Tahiti, that they can all be present at events and conversations, and that's a positive. So rather than just having 50 people in a bookshop, you could potentially have 150 people learning about your new work or listening to the in conversation. So I think every platform has a different purpose. So Instagram is obviously a visual thing it's hard sometimes to post lots of positive things when people are suffering. So I'm very conscious of that as well. So I think there's a bit of self-censoring going on around that at the moment. Twitter is great because you can people follow hashtags for an event they can't be at. Previously, when they weren't online, you'd have a conference or a book launch and people would just follow the hashtag and they're there. They can see what's happening. They can see the quotes. They can see the photos. And I think it's a great way for artists of all fields to engage with their audiences. I think for me, and I think I do that relatively well, and I think I like to promote arts organisations, and particularly now when we're looking for support and so forth, and libraries. And I think one of the things people don't understand about social media, or they don't see it as an effective tool, is because they don't know how to use it and they don't understand that it's about being social. It's not just about an opportunity for you to go and treat Facebook or Twitter as a personal space to vent everything and expect people to engage, because yes, there are times that we have to do that, but if you're looking at it as a professional platform, then you need to understand you need to also be social. because it's social media, you need to engage with your readers. You need to, you know, if you're going to say, this is what I'm, you know, ask a question. What are you reading this weekend? What's your favourite library? Where do you go to write? And actually take an interest in what other people have to say and so forth. And I think that a lot of artists don't understand the power and the way that they can use social media to benefit their craft.
Such useful advice, Anita. You've given me so much already, but I want to ask about your advice for a debut author.
I think from my own experience, I would say don't take yourself too seriously and enjoy the moment, relish the moment. You've worked really hard. It will be easier the second time around.
Anita, can you tell us, please, your favourite novel by a debut author, any time, any genre?
I think I'm going to say Alexis Wright's Plains of Promise. It came out in 1997 through University of Queensland Press. And I remember where I was when I read it. I was at Runaway Bay in Queensland. I was enrolled in my PhD. I think it was the first work of magic realism that I'd ever read. And I thought to myself, wow, there are so many different ways to tell important stories. So I'm going to say Alexis Wright, who's gone on, of course, to be a genius and win the Miles Franklin and so forth. And so there should be no surprises there about that.
Because I know you're such an incredible supporter and you recommend so many fantastic books, I wanted to give you a chance to recommend an extra five. So an extra five books by Indigenous authors that listeners could go out and buy from their local indie bookstores right now to give everyone a bit of a boost.
Okay, I've got five deadly women from across the country. So here we go. The first one, of course, I'm going to say Too Much Lip by Melissa Lukashenko. Many of your listeners have probably already read that. I've read recently this gorgeous book called Girls Can Fly. It's an illustrated book, and it's by Sally Morgan and her daughter Amberlyn Quamelina. And it's just a beautiful book about goals and how that you can reach them and positive affirmations for young girls. Love it, love it, love it. I've just got this week in the post Ellen Van Nieuwen's latest book, Throat. So we're launching it online via Avid in May. So I'm looking forward to reading that. And so I love her work as well. Another collection of poetry, it's by Kiralee Saunders. It's called Art Kindred. So that came out through Magabala Books last year. And so I totally recommend your poetry reading audience to get that. And one that's really close to my heart, I read the first draft of this in 2006, I think, and it came out last year, unfortunately, after Kerry had passed away. But it's Kerry Reid Gilbert's a memoir, and it's called The Cherry Picker's Daughter. So I'd love you to go into wherever your, as you say, indie bookshop is. If you're in Canberra, pop into Barnicare and Paper Chain or Reading's down in Victoria or Avid or Riverbend up here in Brisbane, wherever you are. And if they haven't got it in stock, get them to order it.
Dr. Anita Heiss, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
You can find the show notes for this episode on our website, thefirsttimepodcast.com. If you're feeling so inclined, we would love for you to leave us a review wherever you listen. This helps other people find us.
Get in touch with us via the contact page on our website or connect with the entire First Time gang on Twitter or Instagram at The First Time Pod. And don't forget, you can support us via Patreon. Go to patreon.com/thefirsttimepodcast. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to The First Time Podcast. We recorded this episode at Kathleen Syme Library on the traditional lands of the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. The First Time Podcast is produced by Phoebe 80 and supported by Writers Victoria, the ACT Writers Centre, and our wonderful patrons.